Today on the Rising Coaches Podcast.
And I remember waking up at 4 a.m. thinking, like, I need to go watch this film. I remember getting in my car just screaming. So I was so upset with the way that I coached and the way we played. And as I was screaming, like, almost tears were coming down my eyes. I know you're not supposed to say that. You're supposed to be a man. And that's when I kind of developed the, I got to communicate the expectations and hold them accountable. That's when that came about. That was that moment really hit me right in the face.
Thanks for listening to the Rising Coaches Podcast. This is Adam Gordon, and today we are joined by Darnell Archie, head coach at the University of Mobile. Darnell and I have a great conversation about his journey through hoops, his experience at Butler, both as a player and a coach, and his experience working for and with Brad Stevens, and what he's learned from him. Going away from Butler and working at Incarnate Word for a few years, and then South Alabama, and what it's like to go into the transition of becoming a head coach, where he just finished up his first season at the University of Mobile. And as you heard in the preview, he's very open and honest about that experience and how difficult that is. I really enjoyed this conversation with Darnell. I hope you do too. Please subscribe to the podcast, write us a review, and please follow along with what we're doing at risingcoaches.com. Today's podcast is brought to you by the Rising Coaches Association, the biggest coaching tree in all of basketball. Sign up for the Rising Coaches Association now for just $120 a year and become part of our community, relationships, and development. We talk about it all the time. There's no straight lines in this profession. There's only ups and downs. You need a community that knows exactly what you're going through and has been there before to help lean on during the rough times of the industry. You need genuine relationships, not just exchanging numbers, not just meeting new people at the Final Four in the off season. You should be doing it all year round, and we provide tremendous opportunities to create those genuine relationships all through the year. And finally, development. We have so much content and so many resources so that you can work on your craft and become a better coach. Because we put such a premium and an emphasis on helping you establish new, genuine relationships, it takes all of the political BS side of the business out of the equation for you. All of that gets removed off of your plate. You can just worry about being you, making new friends in the business, and working on your craft and becoming the best coach that you can be and impacting the people that you're around on a daily basis. For more information, visit risingcoaches.com/membership. That's risingcoaches.com/membership. And sign up today. Darnell, what's up, man? Thanks for joining us today.
Hey, Adam. How's it going? Appreciate you having me on. All good here in Mobile, and excited to be on Rising Coaches.
Yeah, man. Yeah, thanks again for doing this. So we've known each other for, 10 years or so. But I was doing some research on you to get ready for the podcast. And I knew you were a good player, but I didn't know that you were the NCAA 3-point champ. And
right,
is this an all time record? 85 straight free throws.
So during my playing year, I made 85 consecutive free throws. It actually took me 3 seasons being a shooting guard, and I didn't really drive a ton. So it took me 3 years to make 85. That is the currently the Division I streak for most consecutive free throws made. Now, there's a D2 guy that made 94 and Division III kid from Indiana, which I know he made 95 maybe or so last year. But I hold a single season, not a single season, career most consecutive free throws made in Division I.
But it sounds like you don't pay attention to it at all. You don't know if people are.
on Twitter, somebody gets close to you, somebody will say, hey, this kid's a 63 or 64. The first so many years, that happened in 2003, so we're going on 17 seasons now, which is pretty remarkable in the sense that it's still held up. There's a lot of great shooters out there. I definitely pay attention when someone gets close, and someone told me that when everybody misses that year, you need to party I think it's a 1972 or 74 Miami Dolphins. I can't remember what year it was. But it's the last team to go undefeated in the NFL.
That's funny. Before we get into your career, first of all, I know you're a modest guy and stuff, but describe your jump shot in one or two words.
Oh, geez. being cocky, I would say smooth. Smooth jump shot, yes. But, you know, if you look at it, you break it down, my left hand, I'm a right-handed shooter, but my left hand kind of comes down with it. So it almost looks like I'm shooting like this with two hands. But as everyone knows, there's no magical formula. You know, you got to rep your constant stroke of what you do. And that's what I did for a long time.
Okay, one thing that, like, no coach I don't think has mastered, or there's always tons of debate on, is, like, what do you think the best way to practice free throws with your team is? If there's anyone qualified to talk about this, right, probably you.
You know, individually, obviously, it's a lot easier. I always try to tell my kids what I did personally, try to challenge myself. Like most people, when you're doing an individual workout, go as hard as you can. And then after 50 or 60 shots, you go to the free throw line and shoot those two. Because I always feel like the first free throw and the second free throw is the most important. A lot of us can go up there and go 9 out of 10, but you missed your first or your second one. You think about it, you only shoot two in a game usually. Not in those times you can shoot three. But as a team, I never really loved them as a player. But looking back on it, I think when a coach sends you up to the line and makes you make three or four in a row and the whole team's watching, it puts that added pressure onto you. I remember in high school, my coach made me make 20 in a row, and I actually did it. I got lucky somehow, made 20 in a row. I was like, man, that was just kind of a waste of time. But I think it really built that mental toughness of everybody watching. If you miss it, the whole team has to run. You know, so I think those are old school drills, but I think it really paid off for me, you know, the consequence shooting in front of your whole team.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, so obviously you had your great playing career at Butler. And then you pretty much go right into coaching at the high school level, right?
So I graduated in 2003. You know, Butler actually went to the Sweet 16 that year. A lot of people don't really realize that, you know, Butler's been good for 20 years. So I love to talk about that, even though I'm not here. They just remember the Final Four run in 2010. Where they come from. So guys like myself and the older generation before me, like, hey, we were a decent basketball team as well. We were, but we were no Gordon Hayward and Shelvin Max, I tell you that.
Did you play for Coach Licklider, or who did you play for?
I played for three coaches in 4 years. I had a guy, the AD there now, Coach Barry Collier. I always say we won too many games. He went to Nebraska. And then my sophomore year, we had Thad Mata. We won too many games, and he left to go to Xavier, and then I had Todd Licklider. So at that time, it was like a stepping stone for coaches. But the thing about us in those years, we kept the same style and system and culture in place that's still there today. So it's just, you know, built on it. I thought I wanted to get into the business world. I sold Yellow Pages for SBC Yellow Pages for about 2 months, and I said, this is crazy. I was like, I can't do this business stuff. So I called up Brad Stevens, who was my assistant coach at the time, and I tried to get into college. It didn't work. I tried to interview for some D3 small schools in Indiana, did not get a sniff. So he said, hey, how about be a JV coach at Carmel High School in Indiana? And I'm lucky the coach named Mark Galloway, who was a great friend of mine, he let me join his staff, and I was a study hall teacher. Which is, sounds funny. So basically I was just supervising kids in study hall for like $8 an hour while being a JV and varsity assistant. That's how I got my start in the coaching.
Yeah, I'm so glad you like told that story, because, you know, so many people want to break into the coaching profession at the college or the pro level, and it's hard for anybody. And you just came off this great playing career.
Yes.
You've got all these great coaches that you – three different head coaches that you played for, probably mm-hmm. trying to help you. You got a young Brad Stevens, who at the time was just another coach, but we all know what he became today, or who he is now. But even for you, with all those things in your favor, you still had to start somewhere, and it was Carmel High School JV team.
Yes, Carmel High School. And our varsity team, we had a guy named Josh McRoberts, who was a pretty good player, you know, went on to be an NBA. So it gave me kind of a skewed view, because when we got in trouble, we just say, hey, Josh, break the press. Hey, Josh, make a play. I was like, this coaching thing's easy. And then all of a sudden, Josh leaves my next year as an assistant. It's like, man, it's a lot harder than we thought. You know, it goes to the whole thing of, you know, players really make the coaches look good at times.
Yeah, and so after a few years there, you get a head high school job.
Yes.
What did you learn through that experience? I imagine you're pretty young and trying to figure it out.
You know, I was got my first job at a 4A school in Indiana called Columbus North. They were having some lean years, you know, struggled to win some games for whatever reason. And I got lucky to get that job. Some things happened for me to get it. And actually my first coaching job, I went down to be an assistant. And 2 days before our first practice, you know, the coach was let go for whatever reason. And I became the interim head coach. So I didn't have any time to really prepare for anything. So I'm just kind of throwing on the fly what I think is going to work. You know, the Butler way was successful. We're going to win a sectional title and be great. And come to find out, man, I got smacked in the face every night. I think our first year was 5-16. As people call it, baptism by fire. I lived it. You know, I was, and I look back on those days because it kind of helps me develop who I am today. It's not that the kids didn't care. You know, to me, I was probably trying to show them more than coach them and get to build that relationship. So I learned a lot from those years and have still learning today.
Can you go into that more? Like you said, you try to show them more than you coach them. What do you mean by that?
I guess the thing is, you know, it's like, as a player, like you said, I had some success. So I felt like I showed them film of myself doing something or like, why can't you guys do this? I wasn't like beating them down in that sense. It was just hard for me to wrap my head around. Why can't we do this? Why can't you understand? It's really not that hard, but it is that hard. You know, I keep forgetting about the years of perfecting our craft. You know, I used to go to the gym with my father every day for like 10 years. So that became habit to me. Working hard became as the normal, you know, putting myself in uncomfortable situations on the court became comfortable for me. So not everybody has that same mentality. So I had to realize that as a young coach at that time. And being in Indiana, that's probably the last place for a 26-year-old to try to go up against some of these monsters in coaching. Cause man, they could coach. It was some of these guys that I coached against. A guy named Coach J.R. Holmes, he has over like almost 900 wins. His son is Jonathan Holmes, who's now at Elon, who I played AAU with. But it's just, I mean, he beat me up. I mean, they were just every little thing I thought could work, they took away. And it was just a very humbling experience, which I think helped me.
Did you get it turned around or what kind of?
I went from 5 wins to 9 wins the next year, which was the most in about 5 or 6 years. Being from the Butler area, I went back to Indianapolis at a private school called Park Tudor, and I knew they had some up-and-coming talent, so I left Columbus, Indiana, go to Indianapolis. There was a kid at the time named Yogi Ferrell, who I knew about, and he was going to be a freshman along with some others, that I think I'd like to coach him. So I went to Park Tudor as assistant AD and head coach. Had a decent first year, but then that summer, a guy named Brad Stevens called me and said, hey, would you like to join us at Butler to be the director of operations? And so I never really got to see that thing through. And the great thing about those young guys at Park Tudor, they had a better coach come in the next year by a guy named Ed Schilling, and he took them to 2 state titles. So it was, he called me one day, which was a nice surprise, and said, hey, I got to give you some credit because you really built the foundation for those guys with their defensive principles and things. But I said, hey, like you did it, you know, you took them to state championships and, that kind of stuff. So that was kind of my ending of high school in 2009 and became on the staff at Butler University.
Yeah, and you were there for some pretty good years with Coach Stevens.
So my first year in Division I coaching, we were on a 25-game winning streak. We went all the way to the national championship game.
Hold on. Let's stop right there. Your 25-game win streak started right after the loss to the Clemson Tigers in Anaheim, which I was on that bench.
That is right. I didn't know that at the time, but yes, that is right. And then, you know, my second year in college coaching, we went all the way to the national championship game again. So extremely, extremely spoiled. Didn't know anything, but really winning at a high level. That summer, Micah Shrewsbury, assistant coach at the time, was poached, as I call him. He went to Purdue University before he went on to Boston. And so I kind of thought, you know, I might have an opportunity to step up and be an assistant. And for many reasons that I look back on now, I understand is Brad decided not to promote me from ops to assistant coach. You know, it kind of sat down. He felt like Coach Shrewsbury was a strong recruiter. You know, I didn't have any experience doing that. You know, we had other two guys on staff, Matthew Graves, who became a head coach, and then Terry Johnson is doing a phenomenal job at Ohio State. I kind of was too close to what they did. So Brad kind of felt like he needed to go out and get another somebody a little bit different. And we got a guy named Michael Lewis, who I love, who's at UCLA. So that was very humbling for me. You know, I thought that I always tell people, you think you know the path to get into coaching, then all of a sudden, wham, it changes just like that. So that was that summer that I decided, like, hey, I need to branch out. So that's when I went to Las Vegas for the Rising Coaches Clinic in summer 2011 and met you guys. And that was one of the best, that is the best thing I did for my career.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Going back and looking at all the people that came through, especially, I mean, even still to this day, the whole 10-year history of Rising Coaches,
right?
We've had so many phenomenal people, but there's something about those first 2-3 years mm-hmm. that were really, really special. And I guess because it was smaller and just getting started, the people that kind of like took the chance and to go out there. It's right. Amazing to see where everyone's at now.
Oh, yes. The guy I got to give credit to is TJ Saint. You know, he's yep. one of your forefathers, I would say, that went there the year before. He was starting to be on our staff as like a graduate manager or something at that time. And we went out there together and, like you said, met some amazing people.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, well, let's go back and talk. We got to talk a little more Butler before we move on with your career path. You've mentioned it and everyone hears it, the Butler way, right? Mm-hmm. So what is it like? Can you define it? And then also define it from your playing career back in, you know, 2000, 2003,
right.
that era to how it evolved under Coach Stevens.
Mm-hmm. And like a lot of programs try to do, you know, they want to set a culture of team over self. And, you know, I got to give credit to Coach Collier at the time. It was probably in the mid 90s. He decided he wanted to have a certain style of play. And he actually stole from some people in the sense of like the coach, the great coach Dick Bennett at Green Bay. They're in the same league. They kind of sat down together and talked about some things. And, you know, Coach Collier made it his own way. I wasn't there for those early years, but Coach Matthew Graves could tell me about those days. But we just had a set of values. And I think he recruited to those values of, you know, high character kids, competitive, and just – I always say as a player looking back on it, I was brainwashed. You know, you can't really say that, but it's funny just to think. But, you know, I think about those values that we have, servanthood, humility, unity, thankfulness, passion, and accountability. Like those are still in my mind. And I think what a lot of coaches do, they have these words on a wall, but do you talk about them enough? Do you really? And they can be anything. They don't have to be those words. You know, if I want to be communication's my key in my program and respect. So let's talk about them. Let's hold people to those standards and let's do those things. I think that's what Butler has did over years. You know, you're going back 25, 30 years now, and they're still sticking with those same values and principles. And that's why they have so much success in my eyes.
So like, other than like, when you say talk about those things, and cause that is the difference. I mean, like you said, every program in the world has got some words posted yeah. on their locker room.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, is it just like the thought of the day before practice starts in the huddle, you're talking about it? Is it literally like every single time you guys come together?
I wouldn't say every day, but I would say 75% of your week. So 4 or 5 times out of 7 practices, you're hitting on one of your principles or you're, I know Brad took it to a whole new level. His brain thinks way better than everybody. But just incorporating different ideas, having different speakers, nothing that no one has ever done. Now, we had some good players at that time too, don't get me wrong. But I think it's just in the sense of the small community that we had at Butler that people believed in what we were doing. And it just really, when you believe in something and you see success and then you keep with that success, that's the one thing that I love what Butler did at the time. Was see a lot of schools do. Barry Collier left for Nebraska. We kept it in house. Thad Mata left for Xavier. We kept it in house. You know, I don't think they really wanted to, but they listened to the players at that time. You know, Todd Licklider left, kept it in house with Brad Stevens. Brad leaves, you know, My buddy Brandon Miller came back, and I think he was going to do a phenomenal job. For whatever reason, it didn't work out, which is a whole nother podcast. But, you know, Chris Holtman was there for a year. He understood it. And then you bring back Laval Jordan, who played there during that times. And so you kind of have that same – even though he brings some of his Michigan things with Coach Beilein, there's still a lot of Butler stuff that's I can see in him that's going on today that we learned back 20 years ago.
Yeah, for sure. And you said Brad took it to a whole nother level. Mm-hmm. Like, in what ways did he do that?
A thing that I always remember being just an example for me, which I'm sure that some of the other coaches did as well, he made everybody feel like they were so important. You know, I'm the director of operations, and I felt like I had a huge job in getting that team to the national championship game. He made my job so feel so important. That's why I tell people all the time. That's what he could really raise the energy level of a room with his whole personality. You could have guys that were walk-ons on the team that felt very valuable. You know, guys that never played, they could sit here and tell you today, you know, was assistant on the Butler staff right now named Emerson Campen. And he felt just as important as Gordon and Shelvin did. That's because Brad pulled him aside a lot. Brad cared about those guys he knew that weren't going to get their names in the paper. He focused on those guys almost more than the Matt Howards and Shelvin Macks of the world, because he knew as a team, it meant more. It really rises the level when everybody's on the same page.
Yeah. And then you said coach's brain works differently than everyone else's. Like, in what way?
He's unbelievably smart. You know, like, he, sometimes I have to ask him, like, he'll say like the word conundrum or, you know, kerfuffle, like that. Like, he made me, he just uses large words that make you think. That's just an example, but the way he's super smart. He, the funny thing is, I remember asking him before he went to the NBA, it's like, where do you get these plays from, these out of timeouts? You know, I'm being a young coach. A lot of people probably do this. He says, you know, when I watch NBA on Thursday nights, I take those plays from those games and I use them the next night on next team. So it's like, man, that's brilliant. There's a lot of teams do that. But that's just something that he did. He was actually preparing himself for the NBA when I look back on it, because he knew he had his goal was to get there. So looking back on those things, you know, out of timeouts, different things which coaches do now, I just feel like he was ahead of his time thinking back on it.
Did you guys get to see his process? So, like, would tell me this, like, staff meetings, would he come in with he'd come in with a whole new plan and it'd be like, holy cow, this guy did a lot of thinking and planning last night? Right. Or would that process, like, would it be like thinking in front of you guys and figuring it out together?
I would say a lot of it, in my eyes, from what I saw, he definitely included the team, not the team, but the coaching staff, but a lot of that was on him. You know, I always thought that, you know, he just something he typed up and was done in 5 minutes, until one day he told me, he said, I spend probably an hour or two a day thinking about the next practice on what I'm going to put down. So, you know, for me, like, as a coach right now, I'm probably spend 10 minutes on the practice plan and like, let's go. But, you know, think about Brad, like, every single day he spent an hour, and then he would present it to, you know, his associate head coach or the other assistants at the time, and he would get their ideas. But he would spend that much time, you know, game planning for practice, which in tune helped him game plan for games.
Okay. Enough Brad Stevens. Let's get back to you.
Yes.
And now, a quick break to talk about our partners at Dr. Dish. As the offseason approaches, it's the perfect time to upgrade your training equipment. At Rising Coaches, we highly recommend you to check out our friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. They are undoubtedly the best and most innovative training machines. Their newest model for schools, the Dr. Dish CT, is a complete game changer. It has a touchscreen that plays training videos, tracks stats by location, and incorporates on-demand workouts and drills from the top programs and trainers in the world. Check them out at drdishbasketball.com or on social media at Dr. Dish B-Ball. Mention Rising Coaches before you purchase and receive an additional $300 off your next order.
Okay, so the decision to leave Butler, or talk about that, like, your next stop and like how that went down.
So my fourth year of being the director of operations, those who've been a Dobo knows that it's fun the first year. The second year is tolerable. And after that, it's like, get me out of this position. You know, it's just, I want to recruit. I want to coach the players. I want to be have the name assistant coach under my title. So that fourth year, we had another great run. And Matthew Graves was up for some jobs here and there. And he told me, he said, I would like to take you. And I was rooting for him hard to get a job. And he said, hey, would you come to Mobile, Alabama? I was like, Mobile, Alabama? Like, where's that? You know, in a sense, it's like, so I had to look it up. And it's like, oh, it's close to some beaches. This might be pretty cool. And, you know, we get down to the University of South Alabama. He got the job in the spring of 2013. And I didn't know anything about South Alabama. I knew they were a Sun Belt power. I knew under Coach Pelfrey and Coach Arrow, they had some success. So when I got down there, I'm like, man, this campus is unbelievable. You know, it's like, I think the people, whatever we want to do, it blew me away how nice the campus and facilities were at South. So it was a no-brainer for me to be an assistant coach and go with my buddy Matthew Graves at the time.
Yeah, and you guys had an unbelievable staff and – yeah, really great dudes that came through there.
You know, we had Coach Russ Williamson. He left Tennessee Tech to come with us. The last 3 years, you had a guy named Brock Morris, who was phenomenal. We had Ron Nord, who's with the Charlotte Hornets now for 4 months before he left us to go to the pros. Had a great time, had some good players. But for those 5 years, you know, we just didn't win games. So we always rack our brains on what happened. You know, people can say you didn't have a good enough players or Coach Graves wasn't this or that. One thing I think about is I think it was sometimes just the fit in the sense of our system, which worked at Butler and works many different places, and our players, for whatever reason, just didn't gel. You know, it just didn't. And the funny thing to think about it is you go back and look at some of our, you know, winning and losing is so marginal. We go back and you could probably look at 5 or 6 games where if the ball bounced this way, we would have been 20-13 instead of 13-20 or so. So I go back and look at that a lot. When teams don't necessarily have the best record, it's just 1 or 2 possessions, you know, missed free throws here, a timely turnover there, which that's basketball. You know, that's basketball. I'm sure you can go back in our Final Four runs, you know, our second Final Four run, we should have lost to Pittsburgh in the second round. A guy missed a free throw, and he thought they were down 1, so he fouled Matt Howard, for those who remember that.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And we went down. And, you know, if the guy makes the free throw, we lose, you know, and he didn't have to foul him, and we never would have went on to the Sweet 16. So those things happen. Basketball is just a funny thing, just the one player here or there. It's crazy.
That poor guy from Pittsburgh, he's blocked it out of his mind, and here you are bringing it back up again.
I apologize.
I'm sure he's not listening. Okay, so after that, you go to Incarnate Word, which is your first kind of step outside of the Butler way, right?
Mm-hmm. So I remember –
Is that weird? Were you in culture shock?
Definitely culture shock, yes. I'll get to that in a second. But, you know, for me, I'm a big guy on dates. I'll never forget, you know, March 8th, 2018, Matthew Graves, you know, my good friend, our head coach, we kind of knew it might have been coming, but he got fired. You know, I say we got fired because I was part of the 5 years for them. And at that time, you know, when you lose your job, that's the first time I ever really lost a job. So it was difficult, you know, but I put my faith in God and put my faith and just kind of reconnect with those connections that I made throughout the years. And then the funny thing, the guy that got me into coaching, you know, Brad Stevens, he came to the rescue. He knew Coach Carson Cunningham was getting the Incarnate Word job, and that was kind of my connection with him. And about a week after being fired, in that sense, I got the call from Carson, and we talked and this and that. And it was actually the Final Four was in San Antonio that year, so I was already coming to San Antonio, where UIW is, and I said, I'm on board, you know, and it opened my eyes up to a different type of coaching. You know, Coach Cunningham's coming from Purdue, you know, motion, a little bit similarities and things, but it's just seeing it a different way than Butler for that 1 year was good for me. I needed something different. I needed to see a different way of learning how to guard things or learning how just to go about a process.
Yeah, absolutely. And then that led you to where you are now, your head coaching job at University of Mobile. Before we get into that and everything that you do there and your experience, you know, obviously you were at South Alabama, which is in Mobile.
Yes.
So I'm sure that connection, you know, played a big part in you getting the head job there. Did you interact with the AD or were you, you know, like what was the connection?
So the main connection and the reason why, I mean, I'm not silly to think this, is why we get jobs is the connections that you have with coaches. We had a manager at University of South Alabama who's now at Alabama named Pat Nyland. Well, his dad was Joe Nyland, who was the coach at Mobile for 20 years, University of Mobile. So I got to know Coach Nyland very well. Coach decided to move on to be an AD across town in Spring Hill. So when I found that out, you know, I had a young family. They're not really young anymore. That my girls are 12 and 9. But when we moved to Mobile, they were 5 and 2. So living there for 5 years, that's my family grew up basically Mobilians instead of really me and my wife being from Indiana. So that played a huge part. My kids loved the school they went to. I loved the city of Mobile. And, you know, I was about to turn 40 at the time, I was kind of ready to get that itch of being a college coach. So I went for the job, and I'm not dumb enough to think that Coach Nyland didn't have a huge say in me getting this job. Now, I had to interview for it, obviously, and everything, but Coach Nyland was huge in me getting this opportunity that I'm at today to take over for him where he was at for 20 years.
Did you know the AD at University of Mobile? Like, did you come across them at all?
You know, I didn't really, because the thing was Coach Nyland was the AD for a while, and then he stepped down his last couple years. So it was definitely a different search committee than most. You know, it was kind of a slower process than what they were going on. It was a very unique process. But, you know, I hung in there from May until they hired me in July. You know, at times I wanted to be like, just, you know, they're too slow with their feet. I'm ready just to, I love it in San Antonio. I'm a Division I assistant. I want to keep building with Coach Cunningham in the Southland Conference. But the other side was I had guys like my coach, Carson, who came from NAIA to get the D1 job at UIW. He said, you got to do it. You know, just hang it in there, stick with the process. And so I'm glad I listened to him because I'd be never know what I'd be missing right now.
Yeah, for sure. So you get the head job after you get done fist pumping and celebrating. Now it's like get to work and figure out. And I'm sure you do this beforehand. You're thinking about how you're going to run your program. Mm-hmm. But, you know, what went into that philosophy? Is it a lot of your Butler roots? I'm sure you take something from everywhere you've been. But talk about your program.
You know, definitely was fist pumping, but also I felt sick to my stomach when I accepted the job. Two reasons. One, we bought a house in San Antonio. So we were there for 1 year, and my wife loved her job. So she's a teacher. She wasn't sure what she's going to be able to get her old job back in Mobile. So you have that nervousness, you know, because it's not just me, you know, it's just you. You can really go here, there, everywhere, but it's a family of three or a family of four now. So once we did that, everything worked out, you know, finally she got her old job back, this and that. But for me, my coaching roots, a lot of it is Butler, you know, a lot of it is Butler, but I think you have to, you know, going into it, I was going to try to do things the Butler way in high school, which I knew now I have to develop my own ideas, my own thoughts, in a sense, take from what you've learned. And my motto this year was going to be whatever it takes, whatever it takes. And then by about a week or two in, I was like, this doesn't fit our team, you know? So I didn't really have a team mantra until about halfway through the season. And I felt like our guys had been through a lot, persevered through a lot. So my whole thing was persistence against the resistance, you know? And I kind of got that from Coach LaValle Jordan when he was up at Michigan, who's now at Butler. But that's our theme now, you know, persevering through the tough things. Their style of play is very similar to Butler, which I'm kind of fine-tuning now. You know, it used to be pack line defense. Now I'm thinking more for sideline, baseline. You know, just kind of fits more of our athletes. And I think that's the thing you have to go into it. I'm in a different area of the country than we were at Butler. You know, in the Midwest, for whatever reason, it's just a different style of basketball than it is in the South. I'm a firm believer. I lived it. That's what kind of hurt us a couple years at South Alabama, was getting used to that brand of ball. Just more athletes. It's more athletes. And it's hard to get some kids from the Midwest down here. So I'm trying to change my style to go with the type of players that I can recruit here.
Yeah, what are some of the biggest, like, lessons you learned, you know, going through this first year at Mobile?
Communication, as everybody say, is key. You know, when I go back and looked, you know, we didn't win a ton of games. We went 13-16, you know, which is the most wins in 4 years, and we had the most true road wins. So we had some success that they haven't gotten the last couple years, which I think is coming. When I sat down and kind of evaluated myself on some things that stood out were accountability, communication, and expectations. I felt like I knew the expectations of what I wanted, but I felt like I wasn't doing a very good job of communicating that to my guys. So I love acronyms. So ACE came to mind, you know, ACE, A, accountability, C, communication, E, expectations. So I said I had to do a better job with my staff, better job with my 15 players on communicating those guys what my expectations were. And then they fall through, you hold them accountable. Very simple stuff we all heard and all the books we have read. But I saw a change in our team once I started doing those things, and which opened my eyes up to, man, relationships, they are huge. You got to have relationships with your staff and with your players and really laying out those expectations.
So how did your communication, you realized you needed to take your communication to another level, which is, I feel like, definitely the lesson all first year leaders learn.
Yes.
And you learn it pretty quickly, hopefully. How did you organize your communication? Was it like every morning at 10, we're doing staff meetings, or was it just grabbing guys and making sure you're having more one-on-one conversations or what?
More one-on-one conversations, more trying to, you know, the thing at my level, it was me and a GA this year. So like I'm used to being on staffs of 8 or 9 guys. So that was the biggest adjustment for me, is not having a staff. Really, it was me and myself and a GA that was a 23-year-old guy that was looking at me for everything, in a sense. And I'm kind of looking at him. I'm used to bouncing ideas off of guys. So not having a full staff definitely changed a lot of things. So I was the one kind of breaking down the film. I was the one, you know, game planning, had to do it all, which I love because I learned so much. You know, I learned so much. And you learn that you better go get some volunteer assistance too. I tell you that. Yeah. You better go get some help, which we have coming. But the main thing we did was just, I tried to go once a week, you know, meeting with guys, which we all do, but I tried to make it more, make sure I was doing that on a daily or weekly basis with guys. And, you know, sometimes you tell, let's say back in October, you know, we have our team meeting, here are our expectations. But how many times do you go back to those meetings? You know, like people forget, you know, people like they, in a sense of, so you got to revert back to what your principles are, what your expectations, and then guys understand, like, thank you for holding me accountable. So you got to kind of hit on that. You see some of the best companies, they talk about their mission statement like every day and, you know, or once a week. And that's something that I learned from that. Like you have to talk about, it's kind of going to the values of what your non-negotiables are. So if I'm just very simple, like if we're we four sideline baseline and a guy drives middle and I don't really say anything, well, after a while, people become comfortable with that. So you have to, whatever your non-negotiables are, you have to hold them accountable for, bottom line,
which we
all know. But just when you move to that seat, you start thinking about so many other things. And when I don't have a big staff, you kind of forget about the little things.
No question. Yeah, you talk about that, and it reminds me back to, like, my JUCO days. You know, I started coaching JUCO in Florida. It was my first job out of college. And so many great coaches there in that league. And those guys, like, you go back and look at it, and, like, they didn't have staffs. It's like what you're talking about. Maybe they had one volunteer assistant, but they're – They're a one-man show, winning like 20-plus games year in, year out, recruiting new roster, like all of it, everything, fundraising, running the program, preparing your team, player development, strength training probably, you know, like all of it. And there's something to be said for that, man. Those are those guys, if you can do that, I firmly believe you can coach at any level.
Oh, yes. And people, you know, the one thing that went back into leaving Incarnate Word to Mobile that I thought about, a lot of people asked me, like, you know, I fought hard to get to Division One in a sense. Now, not as hard as some guys, but I had 10 years experience at Division One level. And they said, are you going to basically throw that all away to go be an NAI head coach? And that hit home a little bit. But at the time, I heard that there was a Coach Ryan Marks that spoke with us in 2011.
Yep. Yeah.
I remember one thing that stuck from me. He said, if you have a chance to be a head coach, go do it. And I think he might have been at Vermont, or I can't remember where, not Vermont. He was somewhere up in Vermont at the time. That always stuck with me. And so when I had the opportunity of being the head coach, I was like, I'm going to bet on myself and I'm going to go do it. You know, no matter the level, I just knew I wanted to be in college. And the funny thing is, it's been a breath of fresh air, to be honest with you. You know, there's a lot of good players in the NAI level that don't get credit. You know, a lot of them were Division I players that have bounced down. The competition's way better than I really anticipated. And the coaches are really good. But just the attitude of the kids, I love coaching them. You know, I love coaching. Not that Division I kids were bad attitudes, but it's almost like, how can you help me get to the NBA? You know, everybody was, that's why I'm here. And some of these kids have aspirations to NAI level, but it's more for the love of the game, I feel like, more. And I love that fact that I'm coaching those guys.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. Okay, I want to go back to this because you kind of alluded to it as well. When you get that first head coaching job, everything does fall on your shoulders, you know, and that's the big, and every decision, every success, every failure is on you. And that is like the big adjustment, right? Just the weight of that, the pressure of that. Can you talk about, if you can go back, or maybe you still experience some of the low moments and some of the times where you're like, the self-doubt maybe crept in, or you're like, man, this is a lot.
Yes. So, you know, as an assistant, you have all these ideas you always throw at your head coach. You know, why don't we do this? Why don't we ice ball screens? Why don't we switch 1 through 5? You know, they all sound great to you. But now when it was my turn to implement those things, I was like, you have to keep it simple. You know, like, yes, I want to guard the ball screen 27 different ways. I think it'd be great. But like I alluded to earlier, I understand that. But young kids, you know, it might be a little bit harder for. But the low point in my coaching this past year was we lost a game we probably shouldn't have. And I remember coming back to the office. Usually you sit there and ponder on it and talk. I just got up and left. You know, I didn't yell at the players. I didn't yell at anybody. And I remember waking up at 4 a.m. thinking, like, I need to go watch this film. And on my drives, about 15 minutes, I remember getting in my car just screaming. So I was so upset with the way that I coached and the way we played. And as I was screaming, like, almost tears were coming down my eyes. I know not supposed to say that, you're supposed to be a man, but it was a good way to release my anger that I had instead of, you know, cussing the team out. I waited till 4 a.m. basically just to let it out. And that's when I kind of developed the, I got to communicate the expectations and hold them accountable. That's when that came about. That was that moment really hit me right in the face, you know, coming into work at 4 a.m. that day and, you know, just get up and go, you know, pick your feet up, and we've lost games, we've won games, and just attack the day.
Yeah, that's powerful, man. I appreciate you sharing that. Yeah. Have you figured out or come up with any strategies about how to, like, manage your own, like, emotions and mental well-being?
Yes. Because
that's a huge part of it too, right?
It definitely is. Like I said, we all know friends and buddies. You know, I know some coaches that have dealt with you know, depression and anxiety. You know, being at University of Mobile, obviously there's not a huge spotlight on us winning games, but, you know, I saw it with Coach Graves at South Alabama, and I could tell at times where, you know, he was a little down on himself. So I would try to pull him aside and, you know, try to give him a pep talk as much as I could. I think it's just being there for the coaches. I think coaches, sometimes we keep a lot of our emotions bottled up, all our anxiety, and, you know, it can ruin you. It can definitely ruin you. So I would say to a lot of coaches out there, if you're feeling those ways, you got to talk about them. Or because I've seen some coaches that has ruined their livelihood in a sense, where they live and die on every single game, which you should as coaches. But once it starts to creep into your family life, you gotta take a step back.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you talked about it, you know, at the University of Mobile, maybe there's not as much pressure, but I've found that the pressure, you know, when you go from an assistant to a head coach, which I haven't done, but I've gone from an assistant to running my own business.
Right.
The pressure goes from external to internal. Like, you're your own boss now. And so you're putting way more pressure on yourself than any external factor could possibly do. And figuring out how to deal with that is really hard work, but probably the most important work.
Right. Now I go back to my high school days. So when I was 27, 28, 29, I dealt with a lot of that there. And that's probably why when I had the opportunity to step aside of being a head coach and go learn under Brad Stevens as a coach was the best thing I did. Because I saw myself, I think back to a lot of those days. When I was losing, I lost some games this year, I handled it way better than I did 12 years ago, which you're supposed to do as, you know, humans, and we grow. But yes, that was, looking back at 27, 28, I didn't handle it very well. You know, which I think has helped me be the coach I possibly could be today.
Do you have any way that you, or like routine or anything of how you end your day or decompress, or, you know, like end work and start family time or whatever, you know, like whatever?
Nothing that really stands out. You know, you always hear coaches talk about, don't bring your problems into your house, which I've done before. And, you know, I have my wife, who I've been married with for almost 14 years. Her dad would always say, you knew what you signed up for, you know, when you marry a basketball coach. And she was an athlete herself. But that's the one thing that I learned from being at Butler is Brad Stevens and all the coaches before, they knew how to separate family and coaching. And sometimes they mingled both together, like, which did a phenomenal job. That goes back into the culture I didn't even hit on. It was just the family aspect. But I think you want to work extremely hard, but there's got to be times when you just have another hobby, whatever that is. You know, my hobby, sometimes you're going to laugh, was WWE wrestling. So I would just, you know, get away for an hour and watch The Rock, which you don't even wrestle anymore, some other guys, just to do something that's totally
out. Who's your guy? Who was your guy in WWE?
My guy right now, if you watch, is a guy named Seth Rollins. I haven't watched in a couple years, but growing up, like Shawn Michaels, the Heartbreak Kid. Obviously, when I was younger, I was a huge Hulk Hogan and Randy Macho Man fan, but I don't watch it much now. But I did there from like 2015 to 2019. That was kind of my escape, looking back on it, just having just something that didn't kind of got me away from the pressures that was going on, you know, watching wrestling, which is fake, but it was great entertainment, and a getaway. Looking back at it, that was kind of my release.
So if I call you sometime during this season, you got some WWE on, I know that you're getting your release. There's something just don't I need to ask you how you're doing.
Yeah, Monday Night Raw, you know, from like 7 to 9, don't call me during that time. I'll be watching wrestling. No, not as much anymore. But that definitely was a nice outlet for a while, which whatever it is, you know, people go fishing, this and that, picking up a healthy, I guess wrestling could be healthy, a healthy hobby that kind of gets you away for a few hours, I think is crucial for coaches.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, last thing, Arch, any like advice you'd have for somebody, whether they're, you know, new in the profession or they've been in the profession 20 years, you never stop dealing with the ups and downs. So right. Any advice for people?
I think the main thing I would say is whatever you think your route could be, you know, like if I go to this spot and we win enough games, I'm going to be this coach, or get my promotion this way. nine times out of 10, it doesn't work that way. So I used to think that, hey, I tell you right now, I never thought I'd be an NAI head coach. We came down to South Alabama. I thought we were going to win some games, and heck, I thought I'd be a Division I head coach right now. It didn't work. It didn't happen. So just work, living, as we all say, working as hard as you can in the moment, and that job will come. You know, try to prepare yourself for the next job, but work as hard as you can, you know, connect with people. You know, I was very fortunate to work with Russ Willemsen. As you guys know, he's unbelievable at meeting people and connecting, and he helped me with that. So just try to meet as many people you can, and don't get down on yourself. You know, don't get too frustrated if things don't go your way. Put your faith in God and just buckle down and work.
Arch, I appreciate you, man. And I do. I appreciate you being one of the first Rising Coaches guys, yeah, being involved back in 2011 and still, you know, giving back to the organization today.
It means a lot. You know, I said, like I said before, that was a turning point in my career, because I was ready to get out of it. And I went there and saw some really inspirational speakers and met some really young guys at the time. And it changed my view on coaching. And I'm glad I went. So I can't thank you guys enough for that.
Absolutely. Arch, thanks again, man. This was great.
Appreciate it. Thank you, guys.
Thanks for listening to the Rising Coaches podcast. Quick reminder, please hit subscribe and write us a review. And please visit our website at risingcoaches.com for more information on the Rising Coaches Association.